Welcome back, pod people, to Cinema D'Amore. I'm one of your hosts, Justin Morgan. I'm here with
Chuck Phillips.
And we are ending the year with the Hudsucker Proxy because there's only so many New Year's movies. I guess we could do Forrest Gump 1 year or something.
We'll get there.
That's our New Year's movie.
Yeah.
It has one scene that takes place during the New Year.
Yeah, so that by default makes it a New Year's movie.
Right. Last year we did The Phantom Carriage, which worked perfectly for New Year's Day.
Yeah.
We shifted slightly to New Year's Eve, although it could be New Year's Day, but everything takes place through the month of December for this film.
Yeah.
It's an end of year film, not a New Year film.
No.
Yeah, it's something that it's almost become tradition to me watching It's a Wonderful Life. I feel like I've watched Hudsucker Proxy like the last 5 years in a row. And before that, it was occasional. And sometimes I didn't even watch it on New Year's because I wouldn't even remember like a New Year's movie. I'm like, yeah, it's the Tim Robbins hula hoop movie.
That's a good way to sum it up.
I think it's fantastic.
That's a strong word.
You don't think it's fantastic?
I'd say it's probably the Coen brothers' like weakest film. But I mean, that is one way of saying it. I think most of their movies are pretty amazing. They only have a couple that I think are not, that falter. But this one's one of them. I've only watched this twice. This is the second time I've watched it since I first watched it when you showed it to me when we were having a New Year's Eve party. I feel like this is one where they do go way too much style, like, and there's almost not enough Coen in it. There's like flashes that you see where it feels like they're inserting their kind of ideas into it, but then there's like whole stretches where it just feels like, yeah, they watched Frank Capra movies and Sullivan's Travels and they're just like, yeah, we'll just do that. And like, they don't try to inject enough into certain parts of the movie. But the parts that feel like very much like Coen, a Coen brothers thing, are fantastic, and I do love them. But there's just too many stretches of the film where like feels like they go on autopilot and they're just content to just be like, yeah, I like screwball comedies. Like, I feel like almost like Hail Caesar is very much in like a similar vein and style of trying to like imitate those 50s Hollywood films. But I feel like it does it better because I feel like they do insert more of that Coen brothers humor and mentality into something like Hail Caesar than they did into this. And I don't know if this is just because this is like one of their earliest movies. I know they said they worked on the script for this with Sam Raimi in 1985, which would have been, they said that was like just when they were finishing up Blood Simple.
It was ready to go in 85. Yeah, I think they were waiting on it like 81 or something.
Yeah,
they've been working on it for a long time.
So it's like, I don't know if it's just like they like finalized it very early in their career before they felt that they could get more, you know, weird and strange as they do with a lot of their other films. But again, like I said, it's to say this is one of their weakest films is just to compare it to the rest of their films that I think are all fantastic.
They're not all fantastic.
There's more fantastic than not. They have a good track record.
It's hard to say what feels like a Coen Brothers film because there's so many times where they don't have any of their signature Coen Brothers feel in it. For like example, I think like No Country for Old Men, it's closer to Fargo, but it really doesn't feel like one of their films, you know? I think the hardest thing with this film, which I can overlook, is the screwball comedy aspect of it. It's like a 10, you know, like it's turned all the way up.
It's more like an 11.
So it's perfect, is what you're saying.
Yeah. Jennifer Jason Leigh might be at like a 15 or a 16 there with her. Her character in particular, like, it's not that she's a bad actress, but she's probably the one that the most felt like the Coens told her to watch, like, His Girl Friday, and were like, just do that. Just do that the whole time. Like, don't do anything different. Don't change anything. Like, have you seen a Howard Hawks film from the 1940s? Like, do that.
I mean, that's exactly what it is. But yeah, who knows what the direction is. This is one of the movies, too, where they only credit Joel Coen for doing it.
Oh yeah, in the early days when they didn't do duos.
Ethan's like uncredited, which did it start here where he started to direct certain scenes?
I think he was always directing, but just they couldn't credit. So Ethan was always the producer while Joel was always the director. And then they were both writers and both doing editing usually.
Raimi was a second unit director on this, and he directed...
On this one, yeah.
He directed the scene where Warring Hudsucker kills himself. And I'm trying to remember.
It's a great scene.
I can't remember what the other one is that he does, but that's him. Probably another scene without Tim Robbins in it, I'm sure.
Yeah, one of the extra ones. I wouldn't be surprised if he did the Bruce Campbell scenes, like just those couple little inserts with just them in the office.
It probably was. That's the only reason that Bruce Campbell was allowed in the movie.
That's what I was thinking too, is like, because that's the only time he pops up is in those two random scenes. He's basically just a cameo in the film in those two moments where they're in the office with Jennifer Jason Leigh. So that wouldn't surprise me if like that's the other thing that he was involved in.
Yeah, I mean, they're really strong on their motifs in this movie too. The circle motif. Yeah. The plot is a circle. It starts at the end and comes around. I do kind of think that it was somewhat genius. The plot of this movie is after the president of the company commits suicide and they're doing so well as a company, they believe that his stocks are going to be up for sale. So they're going to commit fraud by lowering the price of the stock so they can buy them up. And their idea is, we're just going to pick like some idiot that will temporarily ruin this company.
Yeah.
And they find Tim Robbins. I mean, he came from his Muncie college where he's just from simple college that no one's really heard of before.
Yeah.
I do love that scene where Paul Newman, who is essentially like the villain character,
yeah,
is talking to him and he's like, so you're not educated, are you? He's like, oh no, I'm a college graduate. He's like, but
they called
dumb.
You jerk. They called you idiot.
He's like,
no. And he's like, not even behind your back.
I think my favorite thing in this movie too is, before you even realize what it is, I do like the comedy with the circle. Here's my idea. And, yeah, and people, no one questions what it is.
Yeah, they just kind of like look at him like he's stupid every time he shows it. But yeah, no one asks him what it is or like wants any more information about it.
It's a great moment too, where he like looks at the paper and he's like, oh shit, and he turns it upside down. Yep, and it's just a circle. I just think it's funny, like the way that they invent the hula hoop. And once they invent the hula hoop, you're like, oh, this is going to sell big because we know history. It does feel very Cohen and funny though, where that whole chain of events of they can't sell them, so the price goes down to nothing. And then the toy store owner gets mad and throws them out, and that one kid finds them.
Yeah.
I don't know. It has like a very biopic history, melodramatic vibe to it. Oh, he's going to step into the circle when he's going to figure it out.
Yeah.
I like how this little kid's like a professional hula hooper or something. Where like the kids come out and they're just amazed. He's doing everything, going around the ankle, and then there's no cut to him like going around his neck. They just buy it all up.
Yeah,
that's great. A lot of the Cohen stuff that is snuck in there. I love Paul Newman when he falls out the window trying to get his papers.
That's one of my favorite moments.
And he catches him and they have the flashback.
I got you by your pants. And then he just goes, my pants.
He goes back to the tailor that's like, do you want double stitch? Single stitch is fine. You're just trying to like get more money out of me.
You're trying to rip me off.
And then his pants start to tear and he's like, oh, shit.
Yeah. Then you get the double flashback.
Yeah. You get the flashback that's not even his flashback. It's just the tailor's like, oh,
he's a nice guy.
That Mossberger is so nice. I think I'm going to do double stitch.
I'll give him double stitch anyway. Yeah, that's it's like random moments like that that I do really enjoy in this film, is like kind of those odd moments like that aren't necessarily, again, trying to like ape like that classic Hollywood style. It's just a random throwaway joke, but it works so well. I do like, and this is where I like wish the movie went in more of a direction of, is the whole scene where it starts out with him in the mailroom. Like, I almost wanted the movie to be more of a parody of, I don't know, I guess like the corporate structure and how ridiculous it is. Even the way the movie starts when he gets off the bus and he's at that like board for the hiring agency and everything's like 5 years experience, 10 years experience, must have experience. And he's like, well, I don't have, how can you get experience? It's the classic, like, how can I get experience if I can't get a job? Like, where am I supposed to start if I can't get a job without experience?
Jobs are funny too. They were like, I think I saw like third baseman.
Somewhere like ridiculous, like, yeah, like astronaut or something like that. Like, they're all like weird, like some made up jobs. I think one was like a petty thief or something like that. Like, they're all weird. But that's like where I almost wanted the movie to more go, in that kind of parody of that kind of 50s workplace setting. And like I said, when he gets to the mailroom, when he finally by fate gets that job that he finds, and the guy that's like screaming at him, he's like, your number 64578, it will not be repeated. Like, if you don't know your number, you won't get a paycheck. He keeps yelling about how you'll get docked for everything that you do. And I do enjoy that another like weird, goofy, off the wall moment when he's like sorting the mail and all the mailboxes are the same size, except for the one for Mr. Kloppet Jr., which is half the size. He has that big envelope and he's like, and it says like, do not fold. And when he talks to the guy and he's like, what do you do when it's too big? And he's like, well, if you fold it, you get fired. And he's just like, so he writes that note on it. It's like, Kloppet, can you give this to your son? And sticks it in his mailbox instead, which feels like just like a goofy little silly moment. But that's what I almost want more of, or the fear that everyone gets when the blue letter comes down and they all like,
I do like
tear off running,
like perfectly throwing them in every slot without barely looking. And he's like, I've been here for 50 years. He's like, maybe it'll move.
Maybe next year I'll get the parcels. Yeah, if I'm lucky.
I do like when that guy comes in and they all run away and he's like,
yeah, everyone just starts screaming.
Top level. Confidential communication between the brass. Usually bad news. They hate blue letters upstairs. Hate them.
Yo! Yeah, yo, Bonds! You don't look busy! Think you can handle a blue letter? This letter was sent down this morning by the big man himself. That's right, wearing Hudsucker. It's addressed to Sid Musburger. Hudsucker's right-hand man. It's a blue letter. That means you gotta put it right in Musburger's hands. No secretaries, no receptionists, no colleagues, no excuses. Musburger!
Yeah, the emphasis on the blue letter, and then...
Everyone's reaction to it is a great moment. Like the guy in the elevator, the annoying elevator operator that's like, making all the jokes. And then he looks at him and he's like, Jesus Christ, is that a blue letter? Why didn't you say anything? he's like, we got to go express to the top.
Him and Jennifer Jason Leigh are like the two characters that are like that dramatic. Like, I don't know if these people really existed in that time, but they're definitely exist in the movies of that time.
Yeah. No one in this movie feels like a real character. A lot of them feel like just caricatures, other than maybe... I do love Paul Newman in this movie. I feel like he's probably the best part of it. He's the one that feels the least like he's trying to, you know, mimic a particular character or style. He just kind of just goes with it and, you know, does his thing. And then Tim Robbins is good too. Although, and this is like another thing that I noticed again while rewatching this movie, I feel like it's hard to sympathize with any of these characters. Again, partially just because a lot of them feel like just caricatures from something else.
I sympathize with Paul Newman.
Yeah, he does have it hard. He has it pretty rough.
He didn't want to let that cigar go to waste.
No, it'll be a shame for that. But even like Tim Robbins' character, who is basically, you know, supposed to be our hero character, and it feels like it's supposed to show like how this world changed him, which it does. Like, it kind of makes him into like just kind of a jerk. Like he just like assumes everything and, you know, starts like getting, you know, more and more full of his ego because everyone keeps telling him he's like the newest, best guy around as the president of the company. It really does feel like in the end, like you're supposed to think like, oh, he actually isn't. You know, he isn't dumb. He does know what he's doing. But throughout the entire movie, he kind of just does seem stupid from beginning to end. And like, it really just does just feel like dumb luck that he came up with the hula hoop. Like, even though that's supposed to be the joke of like, oh yeah, it was, you know, he just kept showing people a circle and then he called it an invention. But even from like beginning to end, it never feels like there is an actual like transformation in his character. He just does still feel
there's a main character, because he is the protagonist by definition. He's who we start and end the movie with. He is the Hudsucker proxy. He is the pawn. And it feels like it's mostly other people manipulating him.
Yeah. So he never feels like an actual character.
It falls heavier on like Paul Newman's plan or the newspaper's plan, how they're pushing him around. He's almost observed.
Yeah.
It's like he's an animal or something, like in a documentary. They don't really, he really doesn't, from beginning to end, he really doesn't change. Like, I guess he gets depressed enough that he wants to jump off of the highest building in fake New York City or whatever. But I guess that's too, the Coen brothers and Raimi, when they were writing this, they said that is where they started. And they were like, they wrote the script as to like how the character gets to that point and then how does he get out of that point. So they started it with just like him on the rooftop, which I think is why the movie also opens there. I'm also a huge fan of the miniatures. Like, it's a good time where like the miniatures look great, and they repurposed some of them for like the Joel Schumacher Batman movies and stuff. They did a little trick that I thought was neat too, where they, when they did the falling, like the two suicides, I guess, they were able to flip the model on its side so they could get that effect of the falling. This is another movie that they worked with Roger Deakins on. And he was one of the ones like, it's going to look so much cooler if when it falls, it's like a wider angle. And they, I guess they didn't make the model like wide enough. So they had to like play around with the size that would fit best. I don't think this is one of the worst ones, but if you're talking about protagonists, yeah, from that standpoint, it's a little bit harder because there isn't any real character growth. I'd never really hate Paul Newman, but I'm never really cheering for Tim Robbins' character either.
Yeah.
This was like their first, the Coen brothers' like first mainstream movie where like they were trying to get actors that were well known, and they were fighting for Tim Robbins. And I guess the studio wanted them to do Tom Cruise, which just sounds like that generic, Tom Cruise is big, let's do Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
Paul Newman wasn't their first choice either. They were trying to get Clint Eastwood.
Yeah, I'd read that.
Yeah, and he was into it, it sounded like, but it just didn't work out. So, although he, for some reason, Paul Newman really does feel like an Eastwood type character.
I mean, they're both old Western actors. That's where they kind of, that was where they first started getting big back in the early days out of those type of films. So, I mean, they feel very similar enough that like they're not just completely interchangeable, but yeah, it feels like that role would have been played very similarly by Clint Eastwood. Like, I can't imagine he would have really played it that differently. Like I said, there's a lot of those little moments that I enjoy that pop up here and there. I do love the old like clock tower keeper. Like, that's his only job is
Moses.
That's his only job is to keep the clock running. He doesn't do anything else.
He's like a character that doesn't exist in the real world, but almost feels more real than any of the other characters.
Yeah, he's just like this like fantasy character that just shows up when Jennifer Jason Leigh's character goes into the in-between space between Paul Newman's office and Tim Robbins' office where he can get to the clock. And yeah, he like magically knows everything. He knows what she said to Tim Robbins earlier when he was talking about the news articles they've been writing about him. And he knows everything about her already as soon as she walks in. He is like him and the, I guess, again, since they put these two characters together at the end, him and the guy that always is always repainting everyone's door name, who
the
also just feels
guy.
Yeah, who also just feels like a character that doesn't belong in this film. He feels like another weird, like out of place character.
I think he's fine. The slapstick kind of does carry on for some time. Yeah, I mean, even Blood Simple has it. It's just a lot darker.
Yeah.
But they do get funny with Raising Arizona. That has a lot of slapstick feel to it. They kind of step away from it. I mean, they go darker places like Fargo, and they kind of come back where it's Big Lebowski, where they get funny. They go back and forth.
I mean, that seems like that is like a lot of their career has been going back and forth. Yeah, I would say almost other than No Country for Old Men, which is probably their, I guess I would say their least humorous film. Even in their more serious films, they do love to throw comedy in there, like something like True Grit, but they just do like Jeff Bridges is like the comic relief in that whole movie.
Also the main character.
Yeah. Even something like Oh Brother, Where Art Thou feels like that could be the same, almost feels like that could rely on the same thing of being more style. But even that, I feel like has more actual characters in it that feel like real people that will actually grow. Again, then it's filled with all sorts of like weird fantasy elements and goofy stuff that happens, real life characters that pop in and out of the story and comes with all that. But that's the other one that I feel like, even though they're not really super similar, is the one I think of where like they redid something like the Hudsucker Proxy and just did it a little bit better in terms of like making their style fit instead of making a different style fit to them. I know that was a long way to get around that.
No, you went in a circle.
I did.
Yeah, this is a film too that, well, I guess when they were constructing it, I think some of the critiques were people were like, they wanted that same thing as you. They wanted that like business structure. And the Coens were like, we weren't interested in that.
Yeah.
Sorry that that's what you took from our film. And I'm like, you literally keep in your opening monologue, you're talking about the character rising to the top. And what would he be rising to the top? It's the corporate structure, unless you're physically talking about him going up to the 44th floor.
Yeah.
Not counting the mezzanine.
When he does get a call from the basement again, from the mailroom, and that guy's like, Norva, where's my voucher? He's like, I'm the president of the company. He's like, I don't care if you are the president of the company. You need to get me that voucher or I'll dock you.
That boardroom scene is wonderful. I do like the second guy that tries to commit suicide. Yeah. They strengthen the windows. Yeah,
they put plexiglass in last week. Like Paul Newman just had a thought that's like, if people see the numbers, they're going to try to kill themselves again. I better reinforce the windows.
Well, why didn't he open the window? Like, why didn't he break the window? That woman, too, that screams, that big fat lady, that reminds me of something like yeah. She seems like a Tim Burton character. And they get kind of gruesome without showing it. He became jelly on the sidewalk.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ. I wouldn't say it makes fun of suicide, but suicide's very heavy in this film. Everybody falling to their deaths. Or falling in general.
Yeah.
I like fall. Fail. Fall. Yeah, fail.
And fail. Don't fail. No, fall. Yeah. That, I do love when Charles Durning comes down from the sky as an angel, and he's even smoking a white cigar. Like even in heaven he gets those. And I do love his reference to the halo, and he's like they're all wearing them up there. It's just a fad.
The halo is funny though too, because it's,
you can tell it's spinning. Yeah,
it's clearly spinning, so it's clearly hula hoop.
Yeah, it's not just like a ring stuck there in place. You can tell it's spinning the whole time.
The actor that plays the bellhop, who's in The Wire, that plays Pres Belusky, is actually a pretty good actor in The Wire. He's such an oddball in this. And I like when he has his idea, which is also a circle, but his circle ends up being a straw.
Yeah.
That's going to bend. Tim Robbins is like, you're never going to make it. This is the worst idea ever. The
stupidest idea I've ever seen. Can't believe you'd bring this to me.
Yeah, so they start suing him for fraud. And Anna Nicole Smith is in this movie, which is...
Yeah, and not in a speaking role, just to stand there and play a model.
It kind of reminds me of, you know, going back to Singing in the Rain or something. The character with, like, no offense to her, but like the terrible voice, you know, that couldn't survive.
Yeah, the one that can't transition. Yeah, that can't transition to sound films.
Yeah, that's what she kind of reminded me of. I'm sure that was the intent of what she was supposed to remind me of. This movie is goofy, but I don't really think that it's the worst by any means.
What would you put below it? The only other one I thought that I liked less than this was probably Intolerable Cruelty, which I don't... That's another one I'm not a fan of.
Easily my least favorite. Yeah. It doesn't feel like a Coen Brothers film. It doesn't even feel like it should exist.
Yeah, I was like thinking about it. I was like... Because that's what I thought too, is, do I think this is the one I like the least? And I had to like remind myself, I was like, well, what else would I consider? And that was like the only one that I was like, okay, I'd probably put that one as probably my least favorite or their worst film. But
at least you like parts in this movie.
Yeah, there's at least moments that I like here.
When you watch Blood Simple, Barton Fink, this movie, you can kind of see them getting better at their craft.
Yeah,
because Joel Coen started off as an editor anyways before they kind of moved into directing.
Yeah,
the editing in this, I think, is fantastic.
The montages are all great in this. Like, they all work really well. The transitions
moment, too, where they have Tim Robbins, where he still looks like the basement mailroom guy, and he's in the barbershop, and they spin him around.
Yeah,
but it's not just a haircut. He's in the suit now.
Yeah, when they keep transitioning and the photo keeps changing on the newspaper, and it always like keeps pulling out to show the headline. Like, I thought that worked. Like, yeah, again, like the editing's fine. Everything technically is fine in this film. Like, it really just does come down to the story. I think my favorite thing I read was, and I don't even know whose review it was, but they described it basically the same way, that like technically everything is perfect about this film, but much like Tim Robbins' drawing, there's just a hole right in the middle where it feels like a character should be and there just isn't one. And I guess that's like
no character.
That's where I sit is like. I don't hate this movie.
No, I don't think you do.
I feel like it's just I think all there.
If you are saying that this is one of your least favorite ones,
it's just because the other ones are all so good.
Yeah, and you're picking out a lot of things that you like in it. I feel the Coens, they do have movies with great characters when they do stick with a character. But there's a lot of times where they're very unconventional, and I feel like they're always trying to bend or break the rules that have been established with what should be expected in a story. It's a story that's like easier to study than to be like, I do think that the movie is enjoyable. It's sort of always like an experiment of what they can do as a movie and what they can make work as a movie. This thing, of all the bits and pieces that I enjoy, like when you get to the end of the movie and he's got the girl, it is such a weird, undeserved feeling. It would have been better off if they just like ended it when he survived. Go turn that blue letter in.
Yeah.
The end. You never did what you were supposed to do, which is a fireboy offense.
Yeah. But I'm feeling generous since it's the holiday. That's a great moment at the end too, because you really do forget about that blue letter. Because when he gets to Musburger's office, he shoves it in his pocket because he wants to show off his invention instead of handing him the blue letter. And then he hangs up. We see his apron hanging up in the closet numerous times. Like every time Jennifer Jason Leigh she opens his desk drawer and it always just has one pencil sitting in it. Like he has nothing going on. She flips through his planner that always has nothing listed in it. His closet has nothing but his one apron from when he was in the mailroom. So he clearly just has nothing to do. But yeah, as he's jumping to his death, and he just goes, you never gave him that blue letter, did you? And he's just like, oh, I must have misplaced it. It's in your front pocket.
Granted,
where you put it.
He falls to his death. He decides not to do it, but that your maintenance guy shuts the window on him.
Yeah.
And he slips.
Yeah, that's always funny. And yeah, the way the Moses character, it's just like when he stops the gears and just breaks the fourth wall and is like, I'm definitely not supposed to be doing this.
Off the top of my head, there's five times where a character falls or wants to fall, which is Warring Hudsucker, the guy that tries to do the same thing but hits the window.
Yeah.
Tim Robbins' character, technically, I wasn't going to count it, but technically Paul Newman twice, where he catches him by the pants, and the second time where he's like actually contemplating it.
Yeah.
And then that maintenance guy
gets thrown over the balcony.
Yeah, he falls down through the inside of it.
Yeah.
I do like Moses, that narrator character that sticks the broom in there, and he's like, technically I'm not
supposed to do this.
So he's also he's an all-knowing being.
It feels like he is.
But he's also employed by the Hudsucker.
They definitely wanted to use that Frank Capra style, and I do feel like this movie they do try to add those little elements of like It's a Wonderful Life. Like he feels like he's supposed to be like a Clarence character. Like he's watching over Tim Robbins for the whole movie. He's always making sure that everything's taken care of there, and including when he sticks that in, and that feels like a very much like a Clarence thing from It's a Wonderful Life. Like, I don't know, I really shouldn't be doing this.
Think about It's a Wonderful Life. That is like the movie that the structure's taken from.
Yeah.
It starts with the narration, just like It's a Wonderful Life. There's really nothing weird out of the ordinary about It's a Wonderful Life until maybe like the last 20 minutes of the movie.
Yeah, when the angel actually shows up, yeah.
Oh, what if you didn't exist? This movie kind of has that same vibe where logic fits the movie until the moment that he's falling and the character's able to stop time by stopping the clock.
Yeah, and then again, an angel literally comes down from heaven to talk to Tim Robbins. So again, yeah, the end in general
it's
is very
allowed.
It's a Wonderful
Life. It's
in
between time. It's in between time, so it can happen.
Yeah.
At least they don't have, when It's a Wonderful Life, Jimmy Stewart's character is very dense. He's like, what do you mean I'm not here? You know who I am. This angel has told you that you don't exist. He told you very early on, you know, you're going to go around and ask four different people about it. That is definitely a strong influence for this movie.
Yeah.
It's dark like that too, because the moment that steps out of the ordinary is also a moment when the character is contemplating suicide. Although Jimmy Stewart's is way more earned, because literally nothing goes that guy's way in that entire movie. But it does have a bittersweet message. They say it in the exposition that you're the richest guy in Bedford, where it's like, he is, because he was the friendliest.
Yeah.
He built all his relationships and stuff. So I guess that would make Paul Newman the Potter character. But he's not that... I mean, he's a little selfish.
Feels like he's supposed to be, even though Charles Durning is wearing Hudsucker. It looks and sounds exactly like Potter from that film, smoking the cigars and everything like that.
He definitely has the look. It's like if Potter was good.
Yeah, if he wasn't the villain of that story. Like I said, I do enjoy a lot of things in this film. And I do the same thing I said earlier. I feel like they tried to do like the screwball comedy style again with something like Hail Caesar. And I feel like they were a little bit better, almost because that film did take it more as like an ensemble cast. They kind of embraced the fact that there's not really necessarily a central character in that film. I guess like Josh Brolin is kind of acting as the one you follow most in that film, but they kind of embrace more of there's just a whole huge cast of characters, whereas this one still wants Tim Robbins to be the main character. He just can't be because of the way he's written.
Well, I even think too, where you brought up Sullivan Travels. Like, Sullivan Travels is slapstick, but it does have the moments that are really personal, like the scene with the all the prisoners watching the movie and stuff. This doesn't have too many moments like that. So I think when you get to Hail Caesar, they're more selective about the stuff that their comedy is a little bit more unique. It's a little bit more, I think that we'll, I guess when we go into more Coen Brothers movies, we'll have to figure that out, because their comedy is like unlike most comedies, I would say. They do find like a unique way that people try to replicate, but almost none of their comedies are the same. This is a slapstick approach to it, and there's some slapstick in that old feel in Hail Caesar, like you said, but like it kind of evolves from comedy to comedy to comedy.
Yeah, well, that one even is like more, it leans more into like movie musical too with that one.
Because even like some of the stuff from like Buster Scruggs is comedy. Yeah. Although they mix it up where it's like five or six different stories. His is actually pretty funny, the main one. And then there's several jokes throughout. Like James Franco getting hung and he's like, oh, this is your first time. We'll have to dive more into them. I mean, obviously we won't be able to devote an entire year to their filmography. We just don't have that time.
I mean, we could. Yeah, we just become a Coen Brothers podcast.
Until we're done, and then we'll move on to somebody else.
Yeah. I'm interested to see not a Coen Brothers film. Like, it's the first time. Well, the first time since
You'll find out Ethan did direct something. Yeah,
since whichever film they started getting co-credit on, that it's back to just being a Joel Coen film. And I'm interested to see how that plays out and what he continues to do if Ethan never comes back and just Joel Coen just goes on to be a solo director by himself for the rest of his career. Maybe then you'll see more of like who brought what style to it. Like, does Joel Coen just go all drama, like something like continuing like Macbeth and then other like dark dramas? And will it turn out that Ethan was the one that liked all the comedy?
I'll be honest with you, that's what I feel. Don't know, but I've always felt that they got funnier with him in there, but he's always been there, so I don't know.
Yeah,
this is a prime example of, this is a Joel Coen film. Obviously, people that were on set, Ethan directed some of the stuff too, and Raimi directed some of the stuff. Yeah. It's odd to see like how mixed up they are in each other's movies. Miller's Crossing is another good example of, it's kind of like the Hudsucker proxy of their serious dramas.
Yeah.
That moment where they're taking the guy out of the woods to kill him is fucked up, and like that's the strongest moment in that entire film in my eyes.
And we even brought up on our Simple Plan episode, which is a Sam Raimi film, that I said that felt like a Coen Brothers film. Like it reminds you of Fargo. Like, it makes you think of something like that. It has those same connections.
Grew up and live together, and Joel Coen started out as editing, and I know he was like an assistant editor on,
he edited on Evil Dead. Yeah.
Evil Dead. Yeah. So I think that the reason that this got made was that Joel Silver was like such a fan of Blood Simple and Barton Fink. It's kind of like, we wouldn't have Michael Bay without Spielberg. Without Joel Silver, we really wouldn't have the Coens. Like, they might not have taken off.
Yeah,
they might not have been given that chance. So it's essentially, what happens is you have to become a big time director, and you have to have so many fucking projects that you can't handle that you just got to hand off to other people. It sounded like this movie in particular was going to be something that they weren't even sure that they were going to get to direct. It sounded like something that they thought they were just going to be able to sell. And they knew that it was an expensive movie when they wrote it. So I guess kind of like holding off on it, because it does fucking look expensive. And then they get to that point where they can pretty much make anything that they want. And I don't know if it was Snowpiercer or not, but something that we had done recently, or maybe I'm losing it, and it was just something I watched on my own. But I remember seeing like a Coen Brothers producing credit on something that I'm like, didn't know they had anything to do with this movie. Obviously not A Simple Plan, because that's expected, but it was something where I'm like, what the fuck?
Yeah, I feel like you mentioned it to me too, and I can't think of what it might have been.
V for Vendetta.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. So
are you sure you didn't pull a Bill Murray? Was it Eaton Cohen? And you were pretty sure that was going to be a Coen Brothers film with Garfield?
Oh, no, it had their names on it. It was weird.
I don't know why. That's still like one of my favorite stories of all time is Bill Murray. I thought the Coen Brothers were making the Garfield movie. So, you know, I thought...
I never even heard that.
Oh, it's such a funny story. That's There's what he says all the time.
Eaton Cohen.
It's E-T-A-N. That's his name. And Cohen, I think, is spelled C-O-H-E-N.
Yeah.
And that's his name. That's who wrote Garfield. And he is one. I don't know I feel like it could be Bill Murray just like making it up just to like make it not sound dumb. But it's like, but he is 100. He has said numerous times that he's like, I really thought that they were working on that film.
Even if you saw that spelling, you might assume that it was written wrong.
Yeah. Also, I'm gonna say I looked it up and I'm pretty sure you're probably talking about Bad Santa. Because we did reference Bad Santa because you're like, it's produced by the Coen brothers. It's got Billy Bob Thornton. It's directed by the guy that did Crumb. Like, what is this film?
Yeah, that's definitely what it is. Because when I rewatched it, I'm like, what the fuck do the Coen brothers have to do with this movie?
Yeah.
They're also a pair of filmmakers that when their name is attached to something, they're usually a lot more heavily involved than just like a financial, like, yeah, we're backing up this idea that we liked. It usually tends to start as something that like they were writing and they just kind of like handed off to someone else. Yeah, but that is a weird one. Yeah, like that director has done like nothing, so it's just like weird that they got it.
Yeah,
that he got Billy Bob Thornton. I mean, the cast is really good, really good comedic cast. But yeah, I guess it does have that Coen vibe to it, where it's just that humor. It's not just dark. It's like it's for a particular audience.
Yeah,
which I think is what most of their comedy is for. I know a lot of people that are just like, I can't stand Raising Arizona.
Yeah,
it's kind of like this.
Or like I really love. Like one of my favorite movies of theirs is Oh Brother Where Art Thou? And yeah, I know people that are just like, that's the dumbest movie. Like what do you think's funny in that? I'm like, what's not funny in that movie? Everything's
funny.
Yeah. I'm a Dapper Dan man. Like I'll still like, it's like, I just love just stupid stuff like that. I don't want your hair fop. I'm a Dapper Dan man.
Well, that's like the other day I was watching, or last night actually, I watched Candyman because I'm going to watch the new Candyman probably tonight. And Ted Raimi shows up as like the badass boyfriend. And that's always
in the beginning.
He's that guy. But it's weird. And they have kind of like separated. I don't really know if because Raimi started doing, what's his thing called, Ghost House?
Yeah, when he was producing all the horror movies.
Yeah, heavy on that. We know he's doing Doctor Strange 2. And the Coens are always doing, I'm going to still say Coens. Yeah. Ethan's not producing it even. He's not nothing.
I don't think he's anything on it. Yeah, I don't know. Because I know that's what when like they interviewed Joel and he was just like, it was like a weird thing because he just said, yeah, I don't know. I think Ethan's just done making movies or something. Like it almost sounded like, I wouldn't have been surprised if he said like, yeah, I don't know. I haven't talked to my brother in 10 years or something like that. Like the way he described it was just like, I don't know. I guess he just doesn't want to make movies anymore.
It's kind of weird because you told me that I wasn't thinking about it until... we were getting close to the Matrix Resurrections coming out, and it was the same
another
thing
one where
Lana Wachowski was like, I don't know if Lily wants to do movies anymore. I think it happens. I mean, there's people that are like the Scorsese's that are going to do, or in Clint Eastwood's, they're gonna do these movies until they die.
Yeah, they're not taking the Tarantino route of retiring early. They're like, nope, I'm going.
I think Scorsese proves that Tarantino is wrong. Well, Tarantino is afraid that you're going to get old and you're going to make some shitty movies, which kind of is a possibility.
It's happened, yeah.
But Scorsese seems like what is his least critical liked film in a long time is probably, I don't know. I know a lot of, like, not critics, but more so general audiences torn on The Irishman, which...
Yeah.
The biggest critique I get is I would have probably not went with the de-aging. I probably would have just recast them.
Yeah.
I've seen videos on that too where people have done the deep fake on them and the deep fake looks better than whatever the hell technology they did to de-age them. But yeah, like Wolf of Wall Street, Silence. He's moving around and he's making these movies. It doesn't seem like somebody on their deathbed. Definitely, and I will still recommend Cry Macho, cool. Clint Eastwood's new movie. Remember when Clint Eastwood said he was done acting in 2008?
Yeah, but he still pops up all the time.
He continues to act and make himself the lead character.
Yeah.
There's nothing funnier than that movie that's unintentionally like he's supposed to be this. I don't think sex symbol was right, but like the boss, I guess it's closer to a cartel. The leader of the cartel is this woman and she just like wants to fuck Clint Eastwood. And I'm like, this doesn't even make, this seems like something Clint Eastwood wrote and isn't fitting into the world of realism. The movie kind of reminds me a little bit of
Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia.
Yeah, it reminds me of that a lot, actually. But Clint Eastwood's like trying to get this kid and bring him back to his dad in the States. But like, it has a lot of that vibe where it feels like that movie a lot. But then when he's fighting people, he looks like he's going to fall over and break every bone in his body. He should just be nothing but close-ups because he looks like he would kill you. In his close-ups. And he's still sharp, though. Even the ones that he's not in, he's still fucking... American Sniper, I thought, was fantastic. He just has that attitude of, like, go, 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 go. Maybe because he's, like, 90 years old now. So he's like, I doubt I have 10 more years. So we're just going to have to go full speed ahead. Yeah, and I mean, the Coens are actually kind of closely tied to our area, too. Because we have Frances McDormand's from our area. And she's a big Academy Award-winning actress now. Married to Joel Coen.
That's the only reason Joel's still making movies. Because he's got to put her in. She's like, no, Joel, you got to keep going.
It definitely feels like collaboration more than anything.
Yeah.
Because even her part in Hail Caesar was more like a bit. She's funny.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Fucking hilarious.
The editor.
Yeah. The new Macbeth looks fucking amazing to me. Even if it's just the cinematography, but it looks fucking awesome. Because Macbeth is a movie that we need to see again.
Yeah, but there definitely haven't been enough. Haven't been enough adaptations of Shakespeare in general, I guess.
I think I've only seen like 5 adaptations of it at this point. Have to hand it to him. I am excited.
Yeah.
And it's not just Denzel Washington. It's winning me over by like looking extremely unique. I don't know. Something about black and white looks great. When it's done well and it's done intentional, looks beautiful.
Yeah.
They've done black and white before too. There's a little bit in this movie too, isn't there? Or am I losing my mind? I'm just watching too much shit.
When they do like that newsreel footage that John Goodman's narrating.
Yeah.
That's supposed to look like it's on the TV.
I've talked about this before, but I don't know how directly we've talked about it on the podcast. Maybe not necessarily for the entire year. We are going to cover directors as our theme for at least the first 4 months. I think we'll do longer.
Yeah.
But we will try to make it through an entire year if we can.
I think we can.
You want to do movies that you're excited to talk about. And sometimes when you plan something too far in advance, you just aren't feeling it by the time that you get to it.
Yeah.
So we're going to kind of roll into Coen Brother movies. And we're going to do 4 more of them. And I feel like we've kind of spaced it out a bit with time and divvied it up a little bit between drama and comedy. And I think it's going to be an interesting critique of them. Hopefully it's an interesting critique of them. You're like, nothing is very interesting on this podcast. And maybe you're right. That'll be my New Year's resolution to try to make it more interesting if I can. We're moving into them first. We'll kind of hold off, I guess, on who we're doing until right before we do them. But we have the first 4 figured out. So all the way through April.
Yeah.
And I think we might wait till closer to then till we try to pick more people. Or maybe we'll do it not as that far in advance. We'll be like, who do you want to do next week? I kind of know somebody that Chuck will probably pick.
We'll see if you're right.
I'm probably right. Do I got to write it down now?
No, we'll let's
seal we'll it. I'll send it to you, but you don't open it until you make that guess.
Let it go. We'll see what comes up.
What are your New Year's resolutions, Chuck?
I've got none yet. Still got to think on that one.
At the end of every year, the new year has that kind of like reset feeling to it, where obviously it's a general mind fuck where the public just generally thinks, oh, I can be a different person than what I am. And you know what's going to change it? The year. The year will change it. January 3rd comes around and you're like, fuck, this year sucks. But yeah, I mean, like if your New Year's resolution is losing weight or something or cutting out junk, I say cut down on the junk. Don't cut it out. Let's not fail right off the bat.
Just real quick there.
You can eat one bag of chips a week. Don't cut it all out. Bring it down. Yeah. But yeah, we're not necessarily doing, but I've thought about doing, is cutting down our episodes so we can have better episodes, more intricate, fewer episodes, quality over quantity.
We say that now, but then we'll be like, hey, do you want to like redo all the Marvel films?
We're pretty much planning the full fucking year. Yeah. So. Well, I do have something that I've been wanting to do for a long time, but I feel like it's going to take a lot longer to do because I don't have any, like right now I'm off of work. We'll call it vacation. It's like, I don't have enough time to like, I kind of have to write these episodes out. And what me and Chuck generally do are discussions, because I feel like when we get too into kind of trying to educate people, it just comes off as monotone and worse. Some of the episodes where we're all factual do come out great, but most of the time you kind of have to have like an in-between planned and improv. I think that's what makes the best episodes. What I have is definitely 16 episodes, and I think it would definitely have to be made during the time of we're taking a break to develop the episodes and then release them all. We don't really do a lot of television, even though we say that we would. But maybe in the future, we're both huge fans of Twilight Zone. Maybe our New Year's Eve episodes could be Twilight Zone, a select number of episodes that we discuss.
Yeah.
I love that show, probably more than most shows, and there are some very bad episodes on there that I wouldn't want to become a Twilight Zone podcast because I know they already exist. Have I listened to them? No, but I know they're out there. Chuck's like, I'm listening to one right now.
Yeah.
There, I gave you some weird expectations of what we're thinking of as a podcast. Just put it all out there. No secrets from us. We're on Twitter at Cinema de More. I'm at JJMorgan19.
ChuckFinn66.
We're on Facebook too. That's /Cinema de More. That's where you can follow us for our ads. We might bring our ads down too, I think. I don't know if you like that, Chuck.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we'll get it.
Less ads. We're going to be a word of mouth podcast.
More falls into less things to forget to do.
I just want to get to a point, too, where I have enough time to mix the podcast where we don't sound absolutely terrible. Because I've had people say, at work even, what's your podcast? This is the name of my podcast. Can you please not listen to it where I can hear myself? It's like the one thing that it's like, maybe don't give it a listen.
Yeah.
I don't think we're that bad. It's just I don't want to hear myself. But I think other people should, apparently. That was another good year. This is episode 230. Technically, it's kind of more because we've done some special episodes.
Yeah.
The digital world. This is 230. And I definitely think it might be awful. But you're getting... Thanks for podcasting with me, Chuck.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Thanks.